Good morning, Council. Welcome to this November 19, 2024 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our second case on our calendar today, which is Rock Hard Landscape Supply versus Last Chance Ranch. Council, you'll each have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. Please be mindful of that timing restriction, which should be indicated somewhere on your screen, depending on how you have your Zoom settings established on your own computer. Even though we are having this argument by Zoom, interactive online presentation of the hearing, counsel, do please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument, because we only keep an audio recording of today's argument. Counsel, with that, I'll just mention we had one minor glitch last argument. So if there's any point where you can't hear or see someone, please let us know and we'll pause the proceeding so we can get the technology sorted out. Counsel for appellant, with that, you have the floor whenever you're ready to go.
Will do. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is Matthew Francis. I'm the attorney for the appellant here, Last Chance Ranch and Douglas Crosby. I should note right off the bat that this appeal pertains to Douglas Crosby. There was a summary judgment that was entered against both entities. This appeal only concerns the judgment against the individual Douglas Crosby. The reason why we are filing this appeal, Your Honors, we're stating that there is simply not sufficient facts available in order for judgment to have been entered against my client individually. Yes, it's true, he did not participate in the proceedings at all. He did not file an answer with the court, although he had an attorney who had served one on defense counsel, Mr. Nussbaum. He did not respond to any discovery requests and did not appear in any of the proceedings up until he appeared at oral argument on the summary judgment motion.
And just so we're clear on the rules and the application of the rules of discovery, by failing to respond to requests for admission, all of those admissions are deemed to have been made adverse to your client.
You recognize? That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And that's not in dispute.
That is not in dispute, Your Honor.
So does the district court need to pierce the corporate veil in order to find that find your client personally liable for fraud and fraud in the inducement, and therefore hold him liable for the consequent contract, which Last Chance breached, and they're not a party, so it's undisputed that they, on appeal, that the that Last Chance Ranch breached the contract. So why, correct me if I'm, well, if you could, why does the district court need to pierce the corporate veil to find him personally liable?
Because just because somebody is sued and doesn't answer, Your Honor, the district court is still required to make findings of fact, or at least to have a legal basis in order to which impose a judgment upon somebody. I can't, like, for example, sue Your Honor, and just because Your Honor fails to appear, if I don't plead sufficient facts for a judge, the judge and the district court, that doesn't mean I get a judgment against you.
Well, in this case, we have the pleading and we have the admission by failure to respond to the request for admission. Are you saying that the findings that result from the necessary findings as a matter of law, the findings of fact based upon your client's failure to answer the request for admissions are insufficient for the district court to determine that your client engaged in fraud or fraud in the inducement?
In this case, completely, Your Honor. The only thing that it pertained to my client individually was the one provision which says, admit that you have communicated with others under the business name Last Chance Ranch Arena. And by failure to admit to that or deny it, it's deemed admitted. But that's irrelevant. So what? Okay, fine. He communicated with others under that name. The question was not specifically asked, did you communicate with my client Brian's Lawn and Landscaping as that? Did you send letters under that name? Did you write a check under that name? Did you send emails that were under that name specifically and exclusively? I mean, in this case, we have a contract that was clearly entered into between Last Chance Ranch and the landscaping business. Douglas Crosby's name does not appear on that contract. And so in order for the respondents to be successful in this case, they have to allege facts that show that Douglas Crosby was somehow acting either under this other pseudonym that the respondents allege that he was appearing in front of, which is not a registered business in Minnesota.
Right, for the contract claim, I'm focusing on the allegations of misrepresentation. I saw a basis in the complaint for a determinate, the facts that were laid out for misrepresentation, fraud in the inducement against both parties, including your client. I thought there was enough in the complaint to establish that your client participated in the fraud. In fact, was the principal communicator on behalf of the organization.
Right. And we should first note, when you see me looking off the side, I have a separate computer screen left over. So I'm looking over at that and I'm trying to pull up the contract. Your Honor, my recollection until I pull the contract up is that, I'm sorry, the complaint up, is that there was simply not sufficient evidence to allege fraud, even against my client, in that complaint. In the complaint, the respondent, let me pull it up here. All he alleges against my client individually was that he was held himself out as Last Chance Rancherina, which is not a registered business in Minnesota. And then the factual background, he talks about how he's talking about how Crosby represented, but those are all under the auspices of him being part of the corporate entity of Last Chance Rancherina, that are at Last Chance Ranch, Got me a little thrown off here.
I'm looking in the complaint at number 20, paragraph 29.
Okay.
Plaintiff was induced to sign and did sign the contract in direct reliance on LCRI's assertions that it would have enough machines and enough crew to deliver the boulders. And that, in conjunction with the fact that the complaint was charged as Douglas Crosby doing business as the corporation. Not as the principal, but he himself was doing business as the corporation. And here the corporation or Last Chance Ranchery, and I'm not sure whether it's incorporated or not.
Right.
It's representations that it would have enough machines and crew when in fact it didn't.
Right. And forgive me for I keep getting tripped up over the names. But that is why you have to look at the eight alter ego factors that are under the two-prong test from the Hoyt props. And you have to allege those. You can't just simply say, well, because that's why people incorporate. You know,
why do you have to allege those to make out a case of negligent misrepresentation, which I think is part of, not speaking for Judge Ross, but what he's getting at. And there we look, not, don't we? This is a summary judgment. Look not only at what's in the complaint, but also in the admissions, which your client is deemed to have admitted.
But the only thing he admitted that would be harmful against him pertaining to this case was that he did business under the Last Chance Ranch Arena.
I'm sorry. What about the admission that at the time he drafted the contract, he knew that he couldn't procure the contractual number of boulders? That seems like something that he's admitting that might go to negligent.
Right, but that's in his capacity as Last Chance Ranch Incorporated, because that's who entered into the contract. So you, in order to get behind that, you still have to allege facts that show that the corporate veil has been pierced.
All right, let's look at allegation number 34.
Sure.
I'm talking not directly about the allegations against the corporation,
but
your client and LCRI and Crosby. And it explains what both of them did. And then it says defendants, that would include your client in his individual capacity, not just as the principal of the corporation. Defendants supplied false information to plaintiff. And then the next allegation, paragraph 35, plaintiff justifiably relied on defendants, plural, misrepresentation and suffered pecuniary loss as a result of defendants, plural, misrepresentations. Why is that not enough to establish liability for misrepresentation?
If you enter into, oops, sorry, Your Honor.
Okay,
if
yeah,
you
okay.
If you enter into a contract, let's just say, let's go broader with 3M, okay, or a bigger corporation, you are entering into a contract with that corporion. You don't look behind the into an individual within that corporation unless that corporate that individual has done something specifically. But in order to do that, you have to make allegations that they have done something that has gone beyond there that would allow them the corporate veil to be pierced was one of those eight factors. In other words,
I don't understand the case. I mean, I hear you talking about corporate veil being pierced, but
right.
that is for reaching beyond the corporation to get damages from individuals within the corporation. Here we're talking about negligent misrepresentation,
Right.
fraud in the inducement, fraud, misrepresentation, specifically against your client as an
Gotcha.
individual, not just against the corporation. And I'm trying to get a sense of why, if I'm right about that, paragraphs 34 and 35 are not sufficient.
Sure. Now I think I fully understand what Your Honor is saying. The reason is that the respondent in that complaint is simply tying them in together instead of focusing solely on Last Chance Ranch Incorporated. You're supposed to, when you're entering into a contract with a corporation, you have to, and you're dealing with that corporate entity, you're dealing with representatives of the corporate entity. Just because my client happened to be the owner of that corporate entity doesn't mean he's automatically liable for it.
No,
That
not
is why.
automatically, but if your client, I mean, if I'm dealing with 3M and I've got
Right.
or any corporation and I've got a principal or whoever, someone who is acting as an agent of the organization, and that person is misrepresenting what the organization can do, you're saying I have to pierce the corporate veil in order for the district court to find the individual liable?
Correct.
And if that's so, what is the case or I that's news to me, but you can
Okay.
convince me I'm wrong. So cite the authority that stands for that proposition.
Well, Your Honor, I actually would argue the inverse. I look to find a case out there that where a corporation was successfully had the corporate veil pierced where they didn't go through those eight
I'm not
factors.
talking about corporate veil piercing. I'm talking about
Okay.
individual liability for a person, a human
Right.
being who makes representations that turn out to be false, that cause another individual to enter into a contract with a corporation. You're saying that that individual cannot be liable unless there's veil piercing. What
Correct.
if the individual wasn't a member of the corporation?
If they weren't a member of the corporation, well, then that's obvious that you can go against them as an individual. But
Okay, so but if they are a member of the corporation, you can't.
no, because you're entering into the
Oh, that's a,
contract.
and that's where, I mean,
Right.
that's a fine legal point, and I'm just curious, were you able to find any case in Minnesota or anywhere dealing with corporate law that stands for that proposition?
And no, so again, Your Honor, simple fact is the contract was entered into with the corporation, not with my client as an individual. You're now making out when he's when he is
That's always
representing.
the case in fraud and the inducement to enter into
Right.
a contract.
Well, but he is representing the corporation. He is holding himself when he enters into that contract as the corporate as the corporation. When do you separate the two? That's what the Your Honor is asking me is when do we separate the individual from the corporation? And that's why I'm saying that's what these eight factors are for. That's how we separate the individual from the corporation. Up until you do that, when you enter into a contract with a corporation, you're dealing with the corporation, not with any of the individual members of that corporation. And just because in this case we have what appears to be a solely held corporation, like a single, like the only person who owns it is my client. That doesn't automatically make him liable when he's acting in his capacity as as the owner of the corporation. If you are, let me think of another way. It's if you are acting in your matter, like I guess maybe for a tort lawsuit when you're dealing with a municipality, for example, if the person's acting within the scope of their employment, then the entity, the city, would be liable for any actions that were happened to that were committed by that individual. But if an individual went out there and while he's on duty or on the job, assaulted somebody or stole money or did whatever, well, then at that point we can pierce in the entity of the employer and say that individual is wrong because he's acting outside the scope of his employment. And in this case, my client, when he entered into that contract, was the corporation. It wasn't my client individually. He was his capacity as the employer or as a sole shareholder of this corporation. The corporation entered into the contracts, and what he's trying to do about fraud in the inducement, you have to make allegations that there's somehow my client is separated from the corporation. And that just wasn't done here.
Counsel, if I may, because we all dove into this piercing the corporate veil question on the substance, but my big question really for you is why we should consider this argument. It wasn't raised below. It wasn't briefed below. I think someone referred to the Putz case, but that dealt with the well-being of children. So what's the case that tells us the interests of justice should drive us to look at this?
Right. And the interest of justice, Your Honor, is primarily the fact that you should not be entering judgments against individuals unless there's a legal basis to do so, whether they answer a complaint and participate in legal proceedings or not. Additionally, Your Honor, in my reply brief, I was able to research and found that when you look at issues of default judgments, so I didn't find any law on this on summary judgments, but for default judgments, when people don't appear, they are allowed still to make an argument on the merits before this court that the default judgment was improperly raised against them. And I would point to that law as the basis for, we don't even need to get to the issue of raising an issue, arguing an issue for the first time on appeal. It should automatically be allowed to be raised when it's a situation where the person's saying, hey, you didn't have legal sufficiency to enter judgment against me. I see my time's expired.
But counsel, before you, Judge Ross, can I ask a question? Counsel, before you end, you're noting that your research and default judgment, you would agree he appeared at the summary judgment hearing. Therefore, this is not a default judgment. So again, how do we square the fact that he was at the hearing? He could have raised these arguments. He chose not to raise these arguments. And now we are hearing those arguments for the first time on appeal.
Right. I would say, well, simply, Your Honor, first, the respondent filed this as a summary judgment motion, not a default motion. So we have to look at it as a summary judgment, which is why I focused on that initially in my brief. Secondly, when you look at the transcript of the case, I don't believe the district court judge was allowing my client to make really, I mean, he allowed him to speak, but was not really listening to his arguments because he had not filed a filing fee, he had not filed an answer. And so the matter was, for all intents and purposes, kind of going by default. But thirdly, Your Honor, this is analogous. And that's simply there for, if we're having a summary judgment with nobody appears and answers, and there's no legal arguments that are made there. If you allow that for a default judgment for a person to make an appeal on the merits, and I think I'm making an argument for the first time that I see in Minnesota, they should also allow that to be done for summary judgment motion as well. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Jared Nussbaum. I'm the attorney for the respondent in this case. It's the respondent's argument that the court should reject all of the appellant's arguments from the district court judgment against both appellants jointly and severally, including Mr. Crosby personally. The primary argument that the appellants raise on appeal is that the respondents were required to pierce the corporate veil in order to obtain a judgment against Mr. Crosby individually. In my view, Your Honors, the argument fails for several reasons. The first and likely most important reason is that at no time was this piercing the corporate veil issue raised at the district court level, as the court is aware. And I think it's from the LePink versus Water Gremlin Company case, 944 Northwest 2nd 493, in this court in 2020. That it is an elementary principle of appellate procedure that a party may not raise an issue or argument for the first time on appeal and seek appellate relief on an issue that was not litigated in the district court. There's no argument.
What if it's obvious to us that for the breach of contract claim, that there has to be something to establish liability under piercing the corporate veil theory in order for joint and several liability on that claim? Against the individual, Mr. Crosby.
Well, I mean, it still was not raised at the appellate court or at the district court level, excuse me. So, I mean, that why should Mr. Crosby be allowed to essentially sit out the entire litigation at the district court level, have the respondent proceed according to the rules, and then be allowed to bring this argument at the appellate court level for the first time? I don't see that that's in the interest of justice. Certainly, it's a person trying, you know, essentially sitting out the litigation and then attempting to have this court vacate a judgment against him.
Counsel, would you agree that if Mr. Crosby had not appeared at the summary judgment hearing, this would effectively be a default judgment against him?
No, Your Honor, and I didn't bring it as a default judgment for specific reasons. But first of all, I did receive an answer to the complaint from an attorney represented by Mr. Crosby. It was never filed with the court, but I received it, which is why it was never preceded as a default judgment. And second, the requests for admissions were really the basis for the summary judgment here. His admissions, as a result of his failure to answer those requests, were the basis for the summary judgment here, Your Honor.
So just so we're clear, if a plaintiff is served an answer that is not filed, you're saying that the plaintiff could not pursue a default judgment?
I don't believe, yes, Your Honor, I don't believe that, you know, most district courts, from my experience, would enter a default judgment under those circumstances specifically.
But as a matter of law, is there some law on that question that you're aware of?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that you don't have to file a case in Minnesota for a year, I think a default judgment certainly can be, you know, sought in that situation. I don't have any, you know, case law on whether a court would enter it or not, depending on the court. I believe summary judgment in this situation, especially, was the appropriate way to go based on the failure in the admissions deemed admitted, the request for admissions deemed admitted. And then following up on my argument, and it's true that the rule laid out in the LePink versus Water Gremlin case, it's not ironclad, but the court should only examine an issue not considered by the district court in rare cases. This is certainly not one of these rare cases that the interest of justice requires. I think I touched on that a bit. And there's not really any argument as to why the interest of justice may require this, other than we shouldn't be entering judgments against Mr. Crosby or owners of companies, as counsel alluded to in his argument. I would just say in response to that, and I'm looking at the complaint now on my second screen as well, that, you know, Mr. Crosby was named as an individual defendant here. It's not some surprise that Mr. Crosby, the judgment was entered against Mr. Crosby, named as an individual defendant. There's two defendants named: Last Chance Ranch and Douglas Crosby, DBA Last Chance Ranch Arena. He's named in the complaint, number four, as an individual defendant, paragraph four of the complaint, as a party. And there's allegations for fraud in the inducement and common law fraud against all the defendants, not just against Last Chance Ranch Incorporated, and negligent misrepresentation against all defendants, not just Last Chance Ranch Incorporated. So if the argument is that, that all the allegations and a specific allegation for piercing the corporate veil has to be pled, I'm not aware of any authority that supports that. Minnesota, of course, is a notice pleading state. I have no idea where that argument fits in, that there has to be some kind of count for piercing the corporate veil. But in this case, not only is Mr. Crosby listed as a defendant, a specific defendant, a separate defendant, if you will, the allegations are against him. And if they were, even if the corporate veil did have to be pierced here, even if it was a requirement that the corporate veil needed to be pierced, the alter ego theory is not the only way for the veil to be pierced, the corporate veil to be pierced. The court has said on numerous occasions it can be pierced on a fraudulent, for a fraud, if it was the entity was used for a fraudulent purpose, or if there's an alter ego theory, and here, or under the alter ego theory. So it's not, it just has to be the alter ego theory. It's, can it be pierced for a fraudulent purpose if the entity was used for a fraudulent purpose? And the answer to that question, based on the admissions, is yes. There's an allegation that there was fraud here, and those allegations are admitted. So
I have a question about the structure of the complaint, I was a little confused by it. So I think usually when I see doing business as, it's when a company changes its name. In this case, it's Douglas Crosby doing business as Last Chance Ranch. But then I look at count one, breach of contract. That is specifically, quote, against Last Chance Ranch. Quantum Merit, specifically against Last Chance Ranch. Now you've got fraud in the inducement against all defendants. What does that mean? And also negligent misrepresentation against all defendants. What does that mean against all defendants?
That means against both the defendants named. So there's two defendants named, Last Chance Ranch Inc., which is a registered company in South Dakota. And then there's a company called Last Chance Ranch Arena, which Mr. Crosby admits in his request for admissions that he held himself out as, which is a unregistered company. And he admits that in his briefing. There's no company called Last Chance Ranch Arena.
Okay, so all defendants doesn't mean, I mean, it doesn't mean the organizations and the individual. It means both of the organizations and including Douglas Crosby because he's doing business as the arena, Last Chance Ranch Arena. Is that, do I read that correctly?
Correct, yes.
All right. That was confusing to me that I understand your argument.
I don't believe I have anything else. I know I have some time left, so I'm happy to answer any questions, should the court have it.
Doesn't appear as if any of the judges on the panel have questions for you. So thank you for your argument. We'll pass it
Thank
back
you.
to appellant's counsel for any rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me try to answer the court's questions from earlier again. The corporation, we all acknowledge, is a separate legal entity. It's separate from an individual person. That's part of the reason why we set up corporations, why individuals set up corporations, is to have legal protection so that it does not reach against them individually. When Mr. Crosby is entering into this contract with the respondents, he was acting on behalf of that legal entity, Last Chance Ranch Arena Incorporated. That's what the contract says. The contract clearly indicates it's a corporate contract, not an individual contract. So in order for the respondents to have a judgment against Mr. Crosby, they have to allege specific facts that show that Mr. Crosby engaged in fraudulent behavior, negligent misrepresentation, or anything else, not in his capacity of acting on behalf of the corporation.
That's
And
the part, that last part is just the part I keep stumbling over it. And
sure.
That he can't be acting on behalf of the entity. Why can't he be acting in his own capacity?
But they have to prove that. That's my point. When you say, why can't they have to prove that. And that's what those eight
Prove
badges,
what?
they have to prove that he's acting as an individual, not as behalf of the corporation. So when they're making this
Well,
out, because again, it's like if let's just say there's two people involved, not a corporation and an individual. So if you have Joe and Bob, and you're going to allege that Bob's engaged in fraud and negligent misrepresentation, but the contract's with Joe,
right.
will they
So
not?
what if Bob uses fraud to get me to enter into a contract with Joe? Did I say that right? But yeah, Bob is fraudulent to get me to enter a contract with Joe so that Joe is bound to do something that he knows Joe can't do.
Right.
Now, so I enter into a contract with Joe, with Bob as the representative. And you're saying I can't sue Joe, I can't prevail in a claim against Joe, because why?
No, I'm saying you can't prevail against Bob if Bob is acting, if you have two individuals, two
Okay,
separate entities.
why can't I prevail in a claim against Bob for Bob's own negligent or Bob's own misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation or fraud to get me into a contract with Joe, his buddy?
Right, so then you can't sue Joe is my point. So in other words, the corporation is here is Joe, okay? Or I mean, sorry, the corporation is Bob. Bob is the one who's entering into the contract with
What if
the
I don't sue
respondent.
Joe? What if I just sue Bob? Can I sue Bob for fraud in the inducement?
Yes, because that's who you're dealing with. Joe is the
So
person
you're
who's.
saying I would lose that claim if I included Joe in the complaint.
Yes, which is
What's the
what should have
basis for
happened
that?
here.
What's the basis for that?
Because Joe's not doing anything. Joe's not, name is not on the contract. Joe is not the one who's entering into the negotiations. Everything is being done by Bob. Here, Bob's the corporation. Bob is the corporation is the one entering into all the contract, doing all the negotiations, doing everything. And Doug just happens to be there as the individual who owns the corporation. So the respondents are trying to say, well, because you own the corporation, you're automatically personally liable. Well, that's
No,
not
no, no.
contract.
They're saying, as I understand the argument, is you're personally liable because of your own fraudulent misrepresentations, not because you own the business, but because you're engaging in fraudulent misrepresentation to get us to enter into a contract with the
Right, but
business.
they have to
I
show
thought
that
that
he's
was the
acting.
complaint.
They have to show he's acting as an individual and not as an agent of the corporation. That's my whole point on this. When Doug is, Mr. Cosby is acting and negotiating and doing everything, he's doing it as a corporate entity, not as an individual. The complaint, the discovery request, none of that shows how that Mr. Cosby is acting in his individual capacity as an individual person that would be subject to liability for these claims. That is why you have to pierce the corporate veil. That's why you have to show, was this corporation just set up as a paper shield to separate the two individuals? Was did the corporation have separate bank accounts? Does the corporation have separate like insurance for these things? Were there any separate assets that are in the corporation's name, not in Doug Crosby's name? So on, et cetera.
I've always understood piercing the corporate veil to be a theory to get at the damages that the company owes because of the relationship between the company and the principals or the owners. That is based upon the company's liability.
Correct.
In this case, I thought the liability that's alleged in the complaint is against your client specifically.
And I'm saying they don't have a legal basis to do that because the corporation entered into the contract. If Doug Crosby's name was on that contract as an individual, then yes, I 100% would agree with you. But the corporation's name is on the contract. That is who it should have been sued on this case solely. You don't have any.
Well, if the individual's name is in the contract, you could sue the individual for breach of
Correct.
contract.
Right.
But in this case, they're suing the entity for breach of contract, and they're suing your client for fraud to get them to enter the contract.
But
I
they have to
thought those
show,
were different things.
right? But they are two separate things. But you still have to show, just because your honor is making the argument, just because you own the corporation, and then you negotiate on behalf of the corporation, you therefore are automatically liable for any fraudulent for engaging in fraud or negligent misrepresentation, even though you're acting as a corporate agent the whole time. There is no evidence here other than the fact that he owns a corporation to suggest negligent misrepresentation or fraud in the inducement. And that's what I'm alleging is you have to show he was acting as an individual in his individual capacity in order to be subject to this lawsuit. And they haven't alleged anything that says that, just other than the fact that he owns the corporation. That's it. And I'm arguing that that is sufficiently legally insufficient in order for them to sustain their claim. And that's why we brought this appeal. Judgment against the corporation, sure. Against the individual, no. You didn't show anything that shows that they're separate entities.
Well, thank you for your argument, Mr. Franzese, and
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nussbaum. We appreciate your briefing and your oral argument and the conviction in which you have made your arguments today. It's always a pleasure to engage with lawyers who know and understand the law and want to engage with us. We appreciate it. You've both done a good job for your clients. We will issue an opinion within the statutory period. The matter is under submission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bless your days.
And have a good day. Thank you.